Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow-up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are debating who should partner Jude Bellingham and Declan Rice in England's midfield. We'll be picking our top three players in world football and discussing everyone's favourite subject, VAR. Does the released audio clips help or hinder the argument to keep it? Joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got the football correspondent for the Sunday Times, Jonathan Northcroft, a football writer and author of the Times' football newsletter, James Gearbrandt, and a former defender who played a starring role in Scotland under-21's back-to-back 0-0 draws with Moldova, Gregor Robertson. It's international week, isn't it? I had to delve into the archives, yeah. You know. Back-to-back 0-0s with Moldova.
He's a good watch, mate, honestly.
Look, clean sheets are clean sheets.
Absolutely, yeah. Kizzy now's a hard place to go.
Yeah. See, there you go. We've got you back. Now, James, hello. Welcome to the show for the second time this season. I was away for your debut appearance of the season. And Joe, one of my colleagues on the editing desk, was saying, how are you replacing Martin Samuel, who's off on holiday? And I said, don't worry, we've got just the man. We've got James Gearbrandt. And I kind of compared it to a tactical shift from, you know, we're packing the midfield today. We're going for possession. You know, we've dropped Martin, you know, our mercurial number 10, who we just put on the pitch and let him do what he wants. Now we've got, you know, another pivot in alongside Johnny.
So you see me as more of a sort of honest workhorse then?
No, I'd say definitely Martin's a kind of number eight, yeah. A number eight, I would say. Okay, next to kind of Johnny's number six. And then you've, you know, got, yeah, I was, you know.
That's fine.
The engine room, I would say.
Nothing wrong with that.
And then you've
next
got,
to you
know, then you've got Jimmy left back, you know. I was thinking, you know, Mark Cucurella.
Clean sheets.
Mark Cucurella, Chilwell, Ben Davis, if you're being slightly more insulting. But, you know, listen, we've got a great team here today and we've got a great load of topics to discuss, including, and we're going to have to start with VAR again. Now, I'm going to read some headlines to you listeners and just so that you know what we're up against and where we're heading. Headline number one, Howard Webb's transparency drive shows football is better without VAR. The author, Gregor Robertson. Headline number two, the mania for perfect decisions is a nonsense. VAR is failing. The author, James Gearbrandt. Headline number three, Newcastle versus Arsenal farce offers further evidence that VAR must go. The author, Jonathan Northcroft.
I don't actually read my articles, so I had no idea. That was the first time I heard that headline.
like an actor who never watches his own film. Is that what you're saying, James? Yeah. Well, so there you go, listeners. That's what we're up against today. I am going to have to play the Mr. VAR here, I think, because it sounds like you're all pretty against it. But this, Gregor, your piece is the most recent of those, and your piece comes on the back of Howard Webb and his discussions around the audio releases of VAR. Martin Ziegler was writing that the referee's chief says it was right to allow the Newcastle United winner that enraged Mikel Arteta, and also revealed lots of other incidences, the Scott McTominay disallowed goal for Manchester United against Fulham. And that prompted your piece, which I discussed with you yesterday when we were talking about what we might talk about on the pod. And you're not that impressed, are you, really? You're not happy?
No, I've had enough, really, to be honest. Like, watching the mic'd-up the match officials programme that's broadcast on TNT and Sky, which a lot of people have been quite scathing about, and, you know, whether Michael Owen's pushing him, Howard Webb, far enough and trying to draw out answers to difficult questions. I think it's... none of that matters. The thing that was glaringly obvious to me from this was that some incidents, lots of incidents, there are no definitively right or wrong answers, and therefore we've opened up this portal to a whole new world of subjectivity, and the pain's not worth the gain. I mean, when you look through these, the Newcastle, you know, there was so much anger and vented, particularly by Mikel Arteta, about the Anthony Gordon's goal at Newcastle, and after about 5 minutes of reviewing it, they couldn't find any evidence to not give it, which is what the decision was given on the pitch and the field of play. If you look at the one that was most interesting, though, for me, by kind of looking at moving forward, was Wolves' Hwang's penalty for a kind of an aborted challenge on Fabian Schär in a 2-2 draw with Newcastle, because of Webb's response to this. And Webb basically backed up all of the... you know, there are a lot of decisions to talk about. Spoke about Spurs versus Chelsea, Newcastle Arsenal. What was the other one? There was Fulham Manchester United, yeah, and then Wolves and Newcastle. And it was probably the least controversial, actually, but it was the most interesting because Howard Webb disagreed with the VAR Jared Gillett's decision not to intervene. And Jared Gillett came out with a sentence which kind of summed up the absurdity of all this now. He said, after kind of analysing the angles and trying to find out whether, you know, whether there was contact, that it was barely discernible, basically. And there might have been fractional contact, but he really could clearly tell from the audio that he didn't think this should be a penalty. And his kind of final conclusion was, I don't think that's a clear error to not award a penalty kick. Because, of course, the protocol is, unless it's a clear and obvious error, he shouldn't intervene. So we're now in a position where we have technology to correct mistakes. Although, you know, sometimes they're not even clear mistakes and they can't use it. And Howard Webb now... and this is also quite an important kind of central tenet of VAR, because people don't want the games to be re-refereed. They don't want them to be stop-started all the time. They want only interventions for clear and obvious errors. But that is a chimera. That is an absolute impossibility. And now Howard Webb has said on this TV show that in future, going forward with our instruction, we would like the VARs to intervene in this situation. So instead of the high bar for clear and obvious errors and when VAR should intervene, he lowered the bar. So we're going to be seeing more intervention, more re-refereeing, and fundamentally watching it and seeing how difficult a job this is for these guys too. Like, there was this whole conversation after the calamity between Spurs and Liverpool, that we need better humans, like whatever that meant. Like, we're all humans. Like, it's not their fault. They have too much to do and they're being asked to do it so quickly. It's impossible. So my fundamental like takeaway is there's no solution to this. We will just football will continue to tie itself in ever more elaborate and inescapable knots, because the technology is there and people will always want it to be used when they want it to be used.
It's interesting what you were saying about the job of the VAR being such a hard job, which I think is a kind of under-considered point.
Absolutely,
in all of this.
Yeah.
I was researching my column, which I wrote on VAR last week, and I came across this quote by Roberto Rossetti, the former elite Italian ref who ref the Euro 2012 final, I think. And he was saying how an Italian VAR had confided to him that after one match of VARing, the quote was, "I've never been so tired in my entire life." And that was after one match, a pre-season friendly match in 2017, when the bar for intervention was much, the process was much less lengthy than the way we're seeing Premier League VARs operate now. And I do, they'd obviously, there was the incident against Liverpool where there was a clear error made, and clearly they hadn't helped themselves by going to the Gulf in midweek. But I do think it's kind of slightly underconsidered point in all this, how exhausting it must be to be a Premier League VAR, to be running this process week after week under the, you know, this very exacting process, which obviously comes with immense pressure, probably is quite, you know, sort of, it's probably quite a sort of, you know, nerve-wracking thing to do, you know, knowing that if you screw up, you're going to be bringing sort of, you know, a world of pain and criticism on your shoulders. I mean, it's such a tricky subject, because I basically agree with what Gregor says, that once you have kind of, you know, even everything about it is subjective, and even sort of what constitutes a clear and obvious error is obviously subjective. I mean, I do think it's so hard now, because I think now that we have technology in football, we sort of, I think, have to seek what is the right balance between, you know, of technology and football. And obviously, you know, at one end of the continuum, one answer is to simply not have it at all. Would that be the best possible world? Maybe. Like, I sort of, you know, if somebody said to me tomorrow VAR will be completely scrapped and we'll just go back to how it was, I don't think that would be, you know, I wouldn't be particularly upset by that, because I think that would be better than what we have now. But I would also throw in, last night you had a women's Champions League match between Chelsea and Real Madrid.
Yeah, that's really bad timing.
Where you had you had two manifestly incorrect decisions. One involving a penalty where the foul was clearly outside the area, and one involving an offside decision where the player was in fact 3 or 4 yards onside. So I think it would now be difficult to roll back to a place where you don't have any technology, and you have, you know, you don't have the ability to correct those sort of manifestly unfair decisions. I do, just about the final thing, I do think it's interesting for me, in my personal opinion, I think the bar for VAR intervention at the moment is too, I think it should be higher. For me, I think the VAR should be there as a backstop to intervene in these exceptional cases where it's manifestly unfair. And yes, that in itself is a subjective judgment, but I do think it's interesting to read what FIFA envisaged VAR being, and what the referees initially envisaged VAR being back when this was all sort of being explored in sort of 2016, 2017, when the initial kind of idea was that the VAR would maybe intervene sort of once every few games for a few seconds. To me, I think the process should roll back a little bit in that direction. I really don't like what the process has become in games like Tottenham v. Remind me, what was the game?
Chelsea.
Tottenham v. Chelsea, where you had loads of interruptions, where you just, the referee is almost sort of, almost constantly has the VAR in his hand, and almost every single instant is being relitigated. But I recognise it.
But explain to me how we can raise the bar, and how they could have looked at the award of the Caicedo goal, then going back to look at two potential penalty kicks, a potential red card for serious foul play, all in the same passage of play. And this is my point. It's impossible to raise the bar to a certain level and not have to analyse all of those incidents, which takes 5 minutes. Mm. It's impossible.
But I think James makes an interesting point. Sorry, Johnny, just very quickly on the whole, we should remember that, you know, we live in a world of extremes, not just in football. And so I think as much as there's an appetite for get rid of it, and, you know, I was listening to James and thinking probably every listener's going, yeah, I wouldn't mind if they suddenly said it's gone. But you do then have to remember all those moments, Frank Lampard's goal against Germany, Thierry Henry against Ireland, all those kind of moments, which is what started football and the media's clamour we need, you know, cricket have it, rugby has it, why haven't we got it? And I think James makes a good point there that we should keep that in the back of our minds around this debate. But Johnny, over
to you. This is the point, there's no perfect outcome here. And as soon as we all get our heads out of that idea that there's going to be a satisfactory perfect outcome, the better for me. I would tend to be with James that there is a position where VAR could be there as a sort of final backstop, very unobtrusive, only gets used now and then. I was at the 2006 World Cup final, where it was probably the first time unofficially VAR was used, when Zidane's headbutt, and nobody said it, but the referees missed it. Fourth official had seen it on TV and called it back. I was at Stamford Bridge, and I'm trying to remember what year, but it's about 2010, when Oxlade-Chamberlain was sent off, or was it the other way around?
The other way around.
Kieran Gibbs was sent off for Oxlade-Chamberlain pulling off a save on the goal line. And I wrote after that game, we need video refereeing, you know, because at that point it seemed like the obvious solution. But what, and I still think we probably do need some safety net like that, but we don't need VAR. We do not need this at all. I was at the Newcastle game and the Newcastle Arsenal game, sitting in the rain with the fans for 5 minutes, watching the players sort of first of all go nuts, then just get bored and strolling around the pitch while they were trying to decide whether that was a goal or not. Nobody knowing what was happening, looking at pictures on the monitor, but that not making things much clearer at all. One of the takeaways from Mic'd Up was actually how quickly, efficiently and well the VARs were working. Yeah. They couldn't have done any better. I've really got to be really impressed with how decisive and clear they were.
They're good humans.
No, they are. And it's so lazy to be able to say, oh, they just need better referees. We're never going to get those referees that are perfect. That was the process, as Howard Webb said, actually working well, and yet it took 5 minutes, and yet it still fell back on a subjective decision, which was it a push by Joe Linton? Because everything else was the ball being out of play, as Webb said, actually the best person placed to see it was the assistant on the line, in line with it. The cameras couldn't give you conclusive evidence. So that goes back to human decision, which we have to be satisfied with. There was no camera angles to show the offside and no camera angles to satisfactorily show the handball. So it then just came back to a subjective decision. Was it a push? Was it not? And we could argue about that. But we don't need VAR to allow that subjective decision to be made.
I think one of the things that I think about, and we may well come on to this, is that the rules in themselves, in some areas, in my opinion, are too convoluted. Yeah. And so you have VARs who, again, just to kind of remember the context, were brought in really with the intention of sort of eradicating howlers. And now sort of having to make all sorts of very theoretical judgments, like, is this person's arm in a justifiable unexpected position? Is this defensive play a deliberate play or a deliberate action such that it resets the phase? And a lot of these questions, which are very subjective calls around intentionality, are not actually better made. If anything, something calls worse. Around a better made in real time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
To me, that is one area where VAR, to me, seems overly intrusive.
That's right. But another point is that one has led to the other. That rewriting of the rules, that continual sort of trying to pare it down in legalese, is a result of VAR coming in. It's a result of this modern kind of mania to try and achieve perfection. And actually, one of the beauties of football used to be it had the most simple rule book of any sport. It was a ball and it was a simple rule book. But a lot of it was subjective, an awful lot was subjective. The laws around what's a red card tackle has always been enormously subjective. But I'm fine with that. I think that's a game that we love. And maybe one of the reasons that football is having more problems with VAR than a rugby or a cricket is that there are fewer objective binary decisions and there are more subjective decisions for an official to make. And what we're seeing is that adding video and a process in doesn't help with that.
I'm just asking how, you know, if we're all agreeing that if it's going to be here, the bar needs to be raised, how can we ever be in a world where they're not going to check whether a goal should stand or not? I mean, that's quite an important thing in a game. So
does it come back to time then? You know, like talking about the Lampard, you know, the incidents I was citing from the past, the Zidane headbutt.
Yeah.
You know, that's a... Is it a time factor? Because Johnny's also referencing being sat there for 5 minutes while players are strutting around the pitch. I think maybe the incidents you're highlighting...
But this, here's
that's impossible to avoid. It's impossible to avoid.
It takes time, though. No, what I'm saying is, if you can't look at it and go, "Oh, you've tinned that, mate. Quick, you need to change that." There's no. If you can't just look at it and go, "Oh no, God, that's over the line."
A lot of people give that. They say, you know, if you can't tell within 20 seconds, 30 seconds, then it's not clear and obvious error. I would be amazed if we ever come to a position where that's the rule, that's the law. And there's still a potential for being a howler if you couldn't tell within 20 seconds. Could you tell all of those incidents that happened in the Chelsea-Spurs game within 20 or 30 seconds? No chance.
No, I think you'd carry on. And I don't think any fan...
But if they're wrong.
But I don't think any fan, you have
the technology to tell you you're right. But I think this is what no one will ever agree on.
But we've ultimately still got to a point where you're going, that's not... You know, last week we were talking about Marcus Rashford's red card and Tony Cascarino saying, God, that's I need to get rid of freeze frames and stuff. But then a lot of people might say that was quite dangerous. But if you can't do it quickly... Though.
That's disagreeing over a decision. That's fine.
Exactly, that's my point. You can go...
We're going to have that anyway.
Mm. I'll just disagree again and more because we've seen it. I agree
with that. Realistically, there is, as you both said, realistically, there is no, you know, there's no point. I don't think we're going to get to a situation where the VAR process has evolved and everyone agrees that we found, you know, the perfect balance between the flow of the game and decisions. But I also think, at the moment, we have a situation that is not working. For me, the situation at the moment is broken. The flow of the game has been completely changed by, you know, the VAR process. And I think we have to try and make it better. It's really difficult. I agree with that. It's a really, really difficult situation. And if we... role, if you know, however the, you know, whatever change is made, you will still have incidents that are divisive. But I do think that football should aspire to make VAR better. And I think one of the ways in which the VAR process should be better for me is that at the moment it's too intrusive. It's just it takes too much time. And I do think that moving somewhat in the direction of having it take less time and have a slightly higher threshold for intervention would be good. I agree with you that there will be people saying, oh, well, you know, there will be decisions that are perceived to be, you know, that make people angry, and people will then say, oh, well, why didn't it intervene? But for me, what you would get back in terms of restoring some of the flow of the game would be better than what we have now.
I'd move a lot further than that. I mean, I get that, James, but I would move in the direction of not having VAR as we understand it now, having some video backstop. This is Paddy Bartley idea, or Paddy Bartley, our readers might remember. He said this years ago, and he keeps saying it, a fourth official with a video is all you need. Mm. And that fourth official, only if they see something really anomalous do they intervene. That's what we need.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think we're heading in an interesting direction here to talk about one of Gregor's favourite subjects, which is the rules themselves. But can I just quickly ask, because we kind of headed into a very brave territory of trying to fix VAR, for which I commend all of you. But in terms of Mic'd Up and Howard Webb, I just wanted to ask, has it improved, which I think kind of James talked to before with the kind of, wow, what a process it is. Has it improved the refereeing standings in your head, in your mind? You know, for me, for example, Gregor and I were talking about this, the Scott McTominay disallowed goal against Fulham, which again was an incredibly long process. But actually, I found myself going, the guys doing this process have really done it really well. It's the process I have a problem with. The referees themselves. So I'm just saying, from a, you know, we talk about PR in the world and in the world of football. Do you think Webb's done a good thing for referees themselves with this old Mic'd Up? Are you finding yourself going,
well, that would kind of go against the grain of what I wrote about here, which is essentially that the programme illuminated that there is no middle ground. I absolutely have more respect for the VARs.
Yeah, the humans.
Absolutely. I mean, Sian Massey, like, when everyone was kind of getting close to it, looked like sort of coming to a conclusion to decide whether Garnacho was offside or not in that goal, a goal that never was. Sean Massey piped up after about 2 minutes and said, "What about Harry Maguire?" No one else seemed to have noticed that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I hadn't.
Yeah.
And they said, because he might be intervening with play. We can talk about the validity of that rule.
Exactly. That's exactly what I mean.
She noticed that, yeah. and she raised it.
I was impressed by her applying the rules.
Absolutely.
In that sense.
I was impressed by all of it.
I was impressed by all of it
because what they have to do is an impossible job. Hmm. That's what I think.
Well, we're talking about impossible jobs and rules, and Martin Ziegler has written this week about the idea of 10-minute sin bins for dissent, a plan to tackle misbehaviour. Football's lawmakers are also considering adopting rugby rules where only the captain can approach the referees. Good ideas? Johnny?
Yeah, I like that. I mean, the sin bins, I'm toying with that because I understand something has to be done about dissent and crowding of referees and it's unrealistic to brandish red cards at everybody, so maybe sin bin. I'm instinctively against it because it feels, and this maybe is me being a bit of a dinosaur, it instinctively feels unfootballish.
It's just not football.
It's not football, but I can see the logic in it, so I'm open. I'd be open to that. The captain, absolutely. And one thing I've thought of for should happen for a long time, and IFAB could rule on this, is broadcast the conversations players have with referees, like in rugby. Keep the referee's mic on, because that would stop in an instant a lot of the dissent against referees, because players do not want the rest of the public
to look like Greg, mean, horrible
to
people.
Different to know what they're saying to referees and the way they say it at the moment.
Yeah, Gregor.
Yeah, I think Johnny's probably right. Yeah, I think if you were enough publicly admonished for the way you're speaking to referees, it probably would cut down on dissent. And I'm pretty much with Johnny. I don't like the idea of a sin bin. I think you could just brandish more yellow cards. Like, this protocol comes up every few years, encouraging referees to clamp down on dissent, and it lasts a couple of months. It's already starting to wane this season, I feel. But the idea of a captain only speaking to the referee, I've said for a couple of years on the show. I think it's absolutely the right idea, because I think it's one of the worst spectacles in football is the surrounding of a referee and haranguing of referees by a group of players for every decision. And sometimes it can ruin a match, in fact.
One thing that I thought was really interesting is, so I was at Toulouse v Liverpool last week, and the in inverted commas third Liverpool goal goes in. And the Toulouse players, and interestingly, because this, as we all know, that eventually the goal was ruled out for a handball, which was very far, it was quite a long way further back in the phase of play. But the Toulouse players instantly surround the referee in a, you know, kind of quite a sort of apoplectic fashion. Some of them, I think, actually had seen the handball and were gesturing for that. And the referee actually did, I think, book quite a lot of them for dissent. Mm. I think the referee booked, I think, 3 Toulouse players and the coach, I think. Mm. But then, of course, and actually the referee, in fact, pointed to the centre circle. But then, of course, the VAR kicks in and starts reviewing the play and decides that, in fact, actually a handball has occurred. And that is kind of, that's a sort of, you know, sort of weird kind of, sort of, you know, slightly, a slightly worrisome sort of precedent-setting incident, because it is almost as if the sort of, you know, the fury of the protests actually sort of, you know, they kind of, you know, sort of
jogged them into going to the, like,
well, actually, yeah. You saw this in the mic'd up show as well, from the Newcastle Arsenal game. There were I forget who the referee was, and it was maybe Cyan Hooper, was it?
Atwell.
Right, and he kept adding little things in. He's going, potential foul on the back post too. Like, maybe there were 2 minutes into the review, because they're still looking at the ball going out on the touchline, and then they were looking at the offside before that when Gordon first went through. He goes, potential, because obviously the players were coming up to him and saying, and then he went, and somebody had obviously come up again, and he went, oh, maybe a handball as well at the back post. So he's essentially getting information from the players who are protesting. And saying, check for this as well.
He's also,
what's happening there?
He's also saying, I need space. I need some space here. You know, he's hounded, isn't he? He's harangued.
But it proves it works.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, in the kind of modern game now, when things can be checked, a player can go up to the referee and basically say, there was a handball at the back post. And they can relay that to the VAR.
He set a record, of course, in that game for the most bookings in a first half of a match for Descent. I think it's 3 against Newcastle.
There you go.
It's just another kind of interesting to sort of, you know, go back to the whole idea of VAR as a kind of irresoluble problem. It's just another kind of interesting example of the law of unintended consequences.
Absolutely.
One of the reasons that VAR was brought in was partly for the protection of referees.
Yeah.
It was partly because you'd had these incidents, you know, the very famous Tom Henning-Overbur match, and I interviewed Tom Henning-Overbur a couple of years ago. The very famous World Cup playoff between France and the Republic of Ireland, where I think the referee was, I think he was Swedish, I think he's called Hansen something. And you know, these are absolutely career-defining, you know, mistakes that these guys have made that they, you know, they would probably, and you know, which obviously have horrible real-world consequences. You know, these guys, you know, received an awful lot of terrible abuse. And at that point, the logic of having a kind of backstop to save people from, you know, making a completely understandable but, you know, ultimately very consequential error, the logic seemed irresistible. But of course, what you've now unleashed is a world where, rather than protecting referees, their authority has been eroded to such an extent that you're having haranguing of referees. And I thought the Toulouse example was so interesting because it kind of shows, you know, the haranguing is kind of happening because they know that if they harangue, you know, that it would be naive and unrealistic to say that there was never haranguing of referees before. You had, you know,
but no, there's a purpose.
But now
it can have a consequence.
That's my point. But again, what's the solution? I don't know. But
You know, as we're having this conversation, the idea of just a backstop and, you know, the idea that Johnny's saying just a kind of invisible fourth official with a screen feels really like, that's the answer. But I don't think that football can live in that world and accept it. I don't think they can accept having the technology and not correcting the errors that someone else deems not to be quite enough of a howler.
Greg is nearly out of his chair. Johnny, no. Just to wrap up.
Just wanted to ask Greg if he's ever booked for Descent.
I don't think so. I have said this before. I never felt that there was much worth in it, much value in it. And I also, because I was a defender, usually I was too scared about getting back in my position and and not being caught out. So
also that you might have to take a yellow for booting someone, you know, at some point.
Absolutely, so, you might as well, you know, get your money's worth.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there you go, listeners. We're talking about haranguing. That was a good 30 minutes of it there. But hopefully a few constructive points. If you've got any ideas on VAR and how to solve it and how to fix the future of refereeing, get in touch, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. It is international break, so make sure you're subscribed because on Monday we have a very special episode of the Game podcast where myself, Johnny and Gregor talks to a Premier League footballer all about his career. Up next, though, we are talking about England players and we're going to have a bit of fun because all that was a bit serious, wasn't it? Stick with us.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by James Gearbrandt, Jonathan Northcroft and Gregor Robertson. Now, Scotland listeners, if you're excited that we've got Johnny and Gregor on and thinking, great, there'll be a bit of a deep dive on Scotland, you should know that in the planning of this show, I discussed with my good pal Gregor Robertson whether we should talk about your team, and he said, nah, mate, we're already qualified. No, nothing to say. So the arrogance is creeping in. So instead, thankfully, James came up with a very good idea to talk about England's midfield. Now, we're taking the premise of this game that Jude Bellingham and Declan Rice are locked in as two of a three-man midfield. And so we are going to debate who that third man should be. I've also got some listeners' feedback as well, which I'll give to you later on. Who wants to go first? Gregor? Go on.
I think mine's the most boring, though. I mean,
That's why I wanted you to go first.
Okay.
Get it out of the way.
It's Calvin Phillips for me.
Really?
Yeah. And I know that his position
Mister
is
not playing any football,
absolutely,
Calvin Phillips.
We're away from the Euros, and I think he realizes that he's going to have to do something in January. But even if he doesn't, there'll be warm-up games, and I think his performances, one of them wasn't great, but recent performances before that have still been pretty good. And I think the reason that I would choose Calvin Phillips is about control. And I think that's probably the thing that Gareth Southgate prizes above anything else as well. I think also, you know, the kind of makeup of the three is important too, in terms of sometimes who the opposition is, how the opposition set up too. Sometimes you could have one sitter and two in advance, but I think Jude Bellingham's emergence as a genuine number 10 at Real Madrid means that he's going to play as a number 10. It'd be very surprising if he didn't now, I think. Which means it's going to be two midfielders who are tasked more with combining protection and sort of number eight box to box responsibilities, and I think the combination of Declan Rice and Calvin Phillips is the pairing that best supplies that for Gareth Southgate in England.
So is it his defensive qualities, or is it more his game management qualities that you're picking him for? You know, because obviously I'm being mischievous saying he's not playing, but let's assume he's at the top of his game. What is it about his game that makes you want him in there?
Yeah, I think defensive responsibilities, but and that also perhaps will allow Declan Rice to advance. But I think they can both do that. I think they're both quite similar in that they can both advance, they can both support an attack as well as defend. And I think when you've got two players taking up that position, having versatility to be able to do, you know, a bit of a kind of all rounder is the most valuable attribute to have, really. So, but really fundamentally, it's about control. I think having two players who occupy that the midfield space and largely generally don't vacate it too much, I think that's what Southgate wants more than anything.
Yeah, well, Matt Knowles on Twitter agrees with you. He says, Calvin Phillips, his selfless approach enables the other two to shine, and England's best performances have come with those three players working together. That's all that matters. So there you go. Matt and Gregor voting for Calvin Phillips. Johnny, who gets your vote?
Well, I agree with Gregor that it's about control, and I actually agree with the theory of Calvin Phillips, but I think we're talking about 2021 Calvin Phillips and not the guy that's barely played for a year, and that's the problem with him. I think in his last England performance, you could see it with the last couple of performances, you could see the rustiness that it's eroding his game. Now, if Phillips goes to, let's say, Newcastle, and we're coming into the summer with him having 20 games behind him and being back in form, then possibly, probably, At the moment, I just don't think, if it was tomorrow, if the championships were tomorrow, I don't think you could pick him because he's not playing. And I think Jordan Henderson's your other all rounder. And again, I just don't think you can pick him, given the football he's playing at the moment in Saudi Arabia. So
this sounds like you're going process of elimination here, Johnny.
No, but I am. But
we're blessed with all these players. Tom, come on, we're going to win the Euros, England.
No, as
good as you Scots are, we're going to win it. Come on.
You're right. No, you're right. I am kind of maybe slightly laboriously ticking names off, but it's because this is the one position England don't have the obvious solution for. So it's right, we're debating it. But I'm kind of trying to eliminate people to show that it's going to be a flawed selection.
Play a right back
in many ways. And I'm leading up to Trent Alexander-Arnold. Of course I'm glad you've sussed it. But no, I think it is about controlling games. When we're talking about the games that England don't win at tournaments, I mean, with England are very good at winning qualifiers and they're very good at winning the games they should. You could play a more attacking option in those matches. But the games that they struggle with at major tournaments, they get outfoxed in midfield, they get outpossessed in midfield. They don't control the tempo of matches, and that's gone back 20 years of reporting on the England team. And I think Trent Alexander-Arnold would offer you the best chance of doing that. He fantastic in possession. Probably the best deep lying playmaker England have got. His bond with Saka is incredible. And again, in these tougher matches, England sometimes struggle to find that solution to break down the opposition. And I think the passes he can play would give you that. I just think he'd help England keep the ball best. He'd give you that positional discipline of sitting deeper. Declan Rice is evolving as a player at Arsenal and someone who does want to actually go forward up in that left channel. And Trent would allow you that stability.
So I was just thinking as you were talking there, Trent would be the most deepest lying
of
the three.
It'd be a double pivot, and they would probably alternate. But Trent's not going to move as much, I think, out of his kind of zone as Declan Rice might. But his principal job would be to help them keep the ball and then to try and release Saka with those passes. And I just think the other options we might talk about are more attack-minded and are decent players. But England have got enough attacking talent on the pitch, and too many times I've seen an England team, everyone's running away from the ball. Someone's got the ball deep in midfield, everyone's running away from it. And the person on the ball then has no options at all. And I think that need to stay close to the guy on the ball building play and try and connect is really important for England.
Just to play devil's advocate on that then, talking about players running away from the ball, and I was thinking back to a previous podcast where we talked about old England teams of the past, yeah, and Beckham and the tactics, yeah, and I think it was David Walsh talking about Gareth Southgate and looking at it and going, all they do is give it to Beckham and hope he can hit something, yeah, from 50 yards.
Gerard Lampard, run away from the ball.
You don't think that would be a temptation if you had Trent sitting deep with his passing ability, okay, so that you'd be going, go on Rashford or Saka or whoever, Bellingham, go on, over the top you go. Trent can hit you, yeah, from 50 yards.
Yeah, there's that difficulty. And I mean, the big flaw in my argument is that he's not playing midfield. And I'm contradicting myself in a way, because he's not getting that practice. But I think he's shown so much ability when he's played in there, either for Liverpool or England, that Gareth could at least try and give him 7 or 8 games before the tournament to see if that can work. And yes, there is that temptation, but actually a lot of the work he does in there is keeping the ball.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're not alone. Sam and James both agree with you on Twitter. I've also just seen that Blake, a Twitter user, has replied to me saying Mark Noble, which I think that might be a joke. But we shall see. Maybe James Gearbrandt has got a more outlandish suggestion than Mark Noble. James?
Well, no. unless you wanted me to start talking about Ruben Loftus-Cheek, which is
you're allowed. He's an option.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll come on to Ruben. But I mean, to start off with, I would say England are obviously, this is a decision England are making from a position of strength, and I actually would be perfectly happy to see Trent Alexander-Arnold in the role. I actually would be, if Calvin Phillips was playing regularly and playing well, I've always liked Calvin Phillips as a player, and I would be quite happy to see an informed Calvin Phillips playing And I do think there's something to be said for that very, I spoke about it on a previous podcast, but that very sort of clear definition of roles in that midfield three with Phillips as the six and Rice as the eight. And
you don't have to agree with these jokers, James, you know. But you're the guy who writes the football tactics newsletter for the Times. You're the one who knows more than these jokers. Come on.
I think we have... I think there are more options beginning to sort of emerge, and I do think one option that might be worth considering is Conor Gallagher, who's been playing very well at Chelsea, I think. Now, I do think, as I think both Johnny and Gregor have correctly hit on, the sort of, you know, the kind of the nub of the issue is those games against the big teams where England in the past have sort of, they've been outplayed in midfield and they've sort of failed to establish control in midfield. But the interesting question is, how do you establish control in the midfield? Do you play a sort of more controlling player like a Phillips, or do you play someone who can take the opposition's controlling player out of the game, like a Conor Gallagher, who played as well as I've seen anyone play for a long time against Rodri in the game against Manchester City at the weekend? You know, pressing Rodri, being a kind of constant presence and not really allowing him to play as well and be as influential as he usually is. And I think the other thing about Gallagher is, to be honest, I was a bit of a sort of, from a sort of England point of view, I was a bit of a Gallagher skeptic for sort of, I thought he was a really good player. But I think when he came on the scene, he had that really good loan season at Crystal Palace, and even to an extent last season, I sort of thought, really good player, you know, brilliant presser, very energetic, good goal threat, but, you know, is he technically good enough? Is he a good enough passer? But actually, when you look at his passing statistics, his pass completion, it's actually, you know, I think in his season at Crystal Palace, he was sort of, you know, he was completing something like 75% of his passes. This season, it's up at 88%. And against Manchester City on Sunday, he completed 95% of his passes. And that sort of makes me think, huh, okay, maybe this actually is someone that you could sort of trust to sort of play that role and sort of, you know, not be too loose and sort of, you know, not give the ball away too much. I think he's worth considering, to be honest.
So is it like, it's almost a kind of positive defensive move in some respects, you know, thinking into those big games where England have maybe fallen short, the Italy games. You think Conor Gallagher has attributes that would be a positive, but actually they're more about neutralising and disrupting the opposition as much as what he can do with the ball.
That's certainly, yes, that's certainly a key part of what he offers. Is he's an exceptional off-ball midfielder. He has unbelievable work rate, and I think he would give you, he would give you that option of someone who could, you know, sort of, you could try and sort of disrupt / nullify.
That is a perfectly valid consideration because I think actually, like, if we're all being completely honest with ourselves, England don't have that player who can take control, and, you know, you're kind of looking for it when you go for Trent. You're hoping that's he's going to be that guy. We don't really have the evidence to suggest that he is yet, or could be. So, you know, the urge is obvious to go with someone like Trent, but an all-rounder is what I think England need. They need two all-rounders to support Bellingham.
You can't play 12 players, Gregor. Come on. You must know that. But James makes a very good point, and then Pat, who's a listener, also agrees Gallagher could fit in nicely alongside those players if he continues his form for Chelsea. Sam, who's a West Brom fan, saying, I'd like to see Gallagher in there alongside Rice. I've rated him since he was on loan with us, but I didn't think he was international standard. But I've done a U-turn since he's playing regularly for Chelsea and think he could do a good job for England. Apparently, he's won the ball more than any other midfielder in Europe this season, apparently. And that's not my stat, that's Sam. So if it's wrong, it's Sam, it's on you. But so just some other contenders to throw out there. Chris is saying, I'd love to see Foden in there, but it'll never happen. Some people on Twitter saying James Maddison. Obviously, it's Terry on Twitter saying to James Maddison and Foden. You know, they're very attacking options, aren't they? I think that's a dream of a lot of England fans, isn't it? Stick Declan Rice in. Go Jude Bellingham and another one, and them all away.
The thing is, Jude Bellingham has kind of ruined a lot of players' chances, a lot of good players, a lot of good attacking England players' chances because of his emergence as someone who is going to be, he's going to be the number 10. He was the 8, you know, even at the last.
He was, and he was good at the World Cup.
At the World Cup, he was the guy, he was the man in between, the conduit. But he's not going to be anymore. It'd be amazing if he was. because, as I say, you know, he's goal scorer and he's threat. And although, you know, you can roam too. Against Scotland, he was coming deep a lot and to get on the ball and then, you know, making the perfectly timed runs into the box. He can do that. He can operate in that way, but he's not going to be the eight.
I think doing what suits Jude Bellingham as well as should be top of the Southgate's list.
Just ask Jude Bellingham who
just
he wants.
Just ask Jude. But Paul Joyce has written a really interesting column, a piece today, mentioning Rashford and his kind of interplay with Bellingham. Because I think instinctively I'd want to get Foden in the team, but I don't think you can displace Saka or Kane. So you're trying to squeeze him in on the left. But then, as Paul points out, Bellingham and Rashford have got this great rotation, and then you just think you just got to do what Jude wants, basically. But another player, and it's too early, I guess. But Rico Lewis interests me, as if it's not going to be a Trent playing actually in midfield, it might be a fullback stepping in, and he's so good when he comes into midfield at keeping the ball, just his calmness, control. He could be a long-term solution and then you can play Conor Gallagher in the disruptor role further up the pitch and still have in Pep style, create that extra player on the pitch by having the fullback that steps in.
Well, speaking about Pep style, in a dream world where we had an abundance of centre-backs, John Stones?
Well, if you had better central defenders, maybe you could.
Mm. Yeah.
But you don't.
Interesting. James Ward-Prowse, another contender in the, you know, not quite the Conor Gallagher level, but in the kind of workhorse man for the team. No?
No. He's fine. He's absolutely fine. I mean, incredible dead ball skills, fine in possession.
Great.
So, damning with theme praise.
One of the things, obviously, this time, for the last couple of tournaments, you had a 26 man squad, and now you only have a 23 man squad. So, you have to be a little bit more sort of like, you know, you can't maybe have the wild card that you maybe would have done on other occasions. But had you had those three extra places, I would maybe have considered someone like Harry Winks. He's playing very well at Leicester again, and is a profile of player that you perhaps don't otherwise have. But I think with those not having those three extra squad places, he's not going to make it anywhere. And I think the case for taking a bit of a wild card like that is probably reduced by not having that.
I just think the kind of undertone of this conversation is a search for a control. That it's not really something that defines England's play or ever has. So, you know, I can see why England want that. So but what England are is dynamic.
Yeah.
They are a force of nature.
That's
what England's strength is. And I think there's nothing wrong with being fairly solid and secure and unleashing that when they go forward.
So to conclude then, as I know Gareth Southgate's a big fan of this podcast, given how much I love him and David Walsh loves him, we never slag him off. So I know he'll be listening. Who of the other person's nominations were you more convinced by? Gregor, Johnny, Trent or Conor Gallagher?
Conor Gallagher, sorry, Johnny.
Johnny?
No, Conor Gallagher, actually.
James,
my starting point was this would all be solved if Calvin Phillips was fit and playing.
Fine. So actually, Trent is and remains the wild card. I think I was most convinced by Conor Gallagher as well. So James, I think you know, kissing up to James to make sure he comes back on the podcast. But so we're going to move on. We're talking about Jude Bellingham, and that's he forms part of the final debate on the show, which comes courtesy of Johnny Northcroft. Do you want to tell us where the start of this conversation came from, Johnny?
Yeah, I got an email asking me to vote for it was the World Soccer Magazine Player of the Year poll. Now, I think there's thousands of journalists voting for this, so it wasn't like it's not Ballon d'Or. Henry gets the vote for all Europe or whatever, but I tell you what, it interested me because you had to pick the five best players in 2023, men's and women's. But if you didn't cover the women's game, you abstained. So I mean, I could have had a bash, but I abstained because I think it would have been unfair. But so I voted in the men's category, and instinctively, I've always hated that kind of British-centric, England-centric, Premier League is best. You know, I remember back in the day when everyone was trying to say Lampard and Gerrard are the best players in the world, and you had Kaká and Ronaldinho and so many other players doing brilliantly abroad, but we weren't seeing them. So I don't want to be Premier League-centric, and I don't want to be England-centric, but sitting down to make that vote just showed to me how so many brilliant players there are now in the Premier League and how many brilliant players England have got, because it was quite hard to avoid the Premier League and the England options. I'll tell you the top five that I did come up with, which was Haaland at one, Rodri at two, Jude Bellingham at three, and then in all honesty, I could have probably kept going with Manchester City players, and I might have even thrown Harry Kane in there. I didn't. I went for Vinicius Junior and Victor Osimhen just because of the incredible season he had at Napoli, and that being a historic achievement. But I could have put in Harry Kane, and I could certainly have gone down the road of a couple more City players. And it just, you know, I think things really are centering on the Premier League now in terms of talent, and also, my goodness, England do have a couple of genuine World Player of the Year contenders, and Jude Bellingham may well be the number one next year.
Gregor, would you agree with that? Not necessarily the top five, but the general assessment about the strength of both England players within that context of best players in the world and where these players are coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. Although the last time we kind of had this conversation, we were kind of we faced a bit of pushback for because of some of the results in the Champions League.
Yeah. I think we had a conversation.
True. It doesn't matter. It's true. It's the whole conversation we've been having for a while about being the Super League by proxy and the result. You know, that's a result of a concentration of talent and money. I always find it difficult doing, you know, picking players in these sorts of things because when you think about the best players in the world, like you feel instinctively drawn to players who kind of wow you, who exert that kind of control that we've been talking about, and a lot of the people that we're picking actually don't do that. Well, and I would broadly go with you there. I would say Haaland has to be in there. I'd say Bellingham has to be in there, and I'd still say Mbappe has to be in there.
Mbappe was a difficult one.
Yeah.
He's just,
I know he's gone off.
His 2023 hasn't been stellar, but I mean, my goodness, he's obviously one of the best.
But what they are is impactful. That's the word I always use with Jude Bellingham. Like, there are players who are more talented than Jude Bellingham. There are players that are more talented than all of those guys. Mbappe is a kind of a special guy.
Yeah. But, yeah, he is.
But Haaland is kind of, Haaland's about physicality and mentality, and yeah, he's talented and kind of cold-blooded killerness. That's what, so these guys, they impact the game the most, but you know, I have to pick them for that reason, but there are other players who I kind of almost enjoy watching more.
Yeah, I mean, we have a saying on the editing desk when you know, a slightly random European player comes up, who are you going to call? James Gearbrand. So let's see if James can come up with some alternative suggestions for these kind of lists. Or are you in agreement with the guys that generally the dominance of the Premier League and England players is on the rise?
No, to be honest, I think Johnny chose well. I think, you know, Vinicius would certainly have been one that would have come to mind, and Victor Osimhen. But you know, as someone who follows the Bundesliga quite closely, I've been really struck by, you know, quite an up and coming talent who's really shone this year, by the name of Harry Kane.
I honestly thought you were going to come with someone really. I was like, yes, he's going to prove my point about his really in-depth knowledge of random European players.
I mean, I think these polls there's always a slight tension in these sort of votes, or you know, the Ballon d'Or or anything of that nature, between who do you actually think are the best five players in the world, and sort of, you know, and kind of sort of rewarding players who have, you know, had good seasons. But I mean, for me personally, I am pretty convinced that Harry Kane is one of the five best players in the world, and I think he probably has been, you know, for sort of, maybe not a while, but I don't know. I think there's, we've always, I had a sneaking suspicion when Harry Kane was in the Premier League that we had a slight tendency to underrate Harry Kane, because our perception of Harry Kane was sort of slightly laced with this sort of slight element of Spursiness. because he didn't, you know, because he obviously hadn't won any trophies, and there was, you know, sort of a slight, I think that there's kind of a, there's an interesting sort of tonal difference in the way that, you know, people sort of talk about Erling Haaland with sort of, you know, kind of reverence and awe, and Harry Kane, who everyone acknowledges is a very good player, but sort of, you know, never gets spoken about in quite the same way. But I personally had a sneaking suspicion that Harry Kane, for me, I just think he's probably one of the five best footballers in the world, and I think he's probably showing that this season at Bayern Munich.
I totally agree with that, and again, by next year, he might well be, him and Bellingham might be one and two if England have won. How, you've got to mention Messi. I can't have this conversation without
him.
yeah. There's a fella in America who's pretty decent. I mean, clearly, as James said, there's a tension between who are literally the best players in the world and who's had the best year. And if you're picking Earth against Mars 11, to save the planet, of course Messi would be literally the first name on the team. He is literally the best player in the world. Still, but you're voting on 2023, and it doesn't quite justify it on this year's journey for Messi. But just to echo James again, Harry Kane is one of the reasons that the move is so great is we're seeing him in a different context, and we're seeing him continue to develop at the age of 30.
Do you think, even with our more kind of hopefully sophisticated approach to football, and we're talking about Trent Alexander-Arnold as a right back playing in midfield, it does always fascinate me that there's so few defenders ever really featuring these kind of conversations. You know, Gregor, you're talking about impactful. A lot of people can interpret that word in lots of different ways. That could be goals, it could be assists, but, you know, your impactfulness, how do you measure that? You know, we're obsessed with statistics these days. We're also obsessed with highlight reels and clips on social media, and they're just not as fun as watching people tackle as they are of scoring goals. I think Fabio Cannavaro, is he the last defender to win the Ballon d'Or? And also, looking through the list, there weren't many before that as well. I mean, just the final question, best defenders in the world that spring to mind?
Really tough, because if you think of the defenders in the World Cup final, say, you know, I'm not sure how many you'd pick.
John Stones in there?
Ruben Dias, I did think about Ruben Dias for the five.
Yeah.
But didn't quite get there.
John Stones, anyone? I mean, I think John Stones, talking about underrated players, in terms of technical ability, being a modern footballer, for me, is someone that is always criminally underrated. And to take your point, James, about, you know, Harry Kane being slightly downtrodden by the Spursiness, I wonder whether sometimes John Stones on the international stage, because England have a crap defence, he kind of gets forgotten in that crap defence as actually being pretty damn good a lot of the time. Anyone having anyone else? Defenders? Come on, Gregor.
I don't know. I mean, I think someone like Saliba could come into that conversation, because he looks so kind of, combines this kind of towering strength with like an elegance, which is quite rare, I think. But you're absolutely right. I remember doing a piece when Virgil van Dijk won the Player of the Year award, and I spoke to all the other defenders who won the PFA Player of the Year award, and there was only Norman Hunter, Colin Todd, Gary Pallister and Paul McGrath and John Terry. So there was only five before him in I think it was like 40 odd year history of it. It's quite a job tracking them all down, actually, but it was interesting. The fact that they're saying that you have to be exceptional, you have to be so much, you know, so much better. It's not just like, you know, as we're saying, if a striker's impactful, they're scoring 30 goals in the season, whatever. Haaland's obviously taking that to new heights. It smacks you in the face. A defender has to be like Van Dijk was at his peak there, imperious and like something on a different plane to what we're used to seeing of defenders. So that's rare. I think Saliba could get to that point, but he's not there yet.
We might have some underappreciated defenders in world football, but we've got one very appreciated defender on this podcast, Gregor Robertson. Thank you very much for your insights today. And Johnny Northcroft and James Gearbrand, thank you very much for joining me. As I said, make sure you're subscribed and checking us out, because we have a very special episode of this show coming out on Monday. And then, Gregor, you'll be in charge, as I'm taking a little bit of a holiday after that. So I'll leave you in his very capable hands, and hopefully he doesn't just talk about Scotland winning the Euros. Thanks for listening.